Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible, educational, and fun. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Scott Braun from Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Braun previously led NASA's Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission, a five-year mission using unmanned aircraft to investigate Atlantic hurricanes. He's now the project scientist for a future mission. It's a 2020 Tropics Hurricane mission, and we're going to define that and talk about that a little later in the program. We look forward to our conversation with Dr. Braun, where we will discuss what we learned from the 2017 hurricane season and what we can expect in the future.
Good morning, John. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Our second guest this morning is Dr. Compton Tucker. He's a senior research scientist for NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. This fall marked 20 years since NASA has continuously observed not just the physical properties of our planet, but the one thing that makes Earth unique among the thousands of other worlds we've discovered: life. Since the fall of 1997, NASA satellites have continuously and globally observed all plant life at the surface of the land and ocean. Dr. Tucker will join us to talk about how this view of life from space is furthering knowledge of our home planet and the search for life in other worlds.
These two guests plus today's cool story when we return. You're listening to Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Additional funding for programming is funded by Sotheby's Cares, the philanthropic arm of Summit Sotheby's International Realty. Kathleen Barlow, now with Raymond James & Associates Incorporated. Kathleen.Barlow@RaymondJames.com. Park City Bike Demos, Kern's showroom next to Adolph's. Park City Day School, small community, big education, infinite possibilities. ParkCityDayschool.org. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Do you have gently used furniture, appliances, cabinets, or building materials that need a new home? Donate them to the Habitat Restore and help local hardworking families. You can bring your items to us or schedule a pickup at 435-658-1400. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Well, we're going to switch it up a bit this morning. We're having some difficulty getting our first guest on the line, so we'll go to our second guest, Dr. Compton Tucker. He's a senior research scientist for NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. John spoke with Dr. Tucker a couple of weeks ago in this pre-taped conversation. It's important to note that a companion animation is available for this interview, and it can be viewed by Googling earth.nasa.gov. It's a great animation. And here's that interview.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. This fall marks 20 years since NASA has continuously observed not just the physical properties of our planet, but the one thing that makes Earth unique among the thousands of other worlds we've discovered: life. An animation released today captures the entirety of this 20-year record made possible by multiple satellites compressing a decades-long view of life on Earth into a captivating few minutes. Dr. Compton Tucker, senior research scientist, joins us from Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dr. Compton, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you here. This is a tremendous, tremendous announcement, and I've been following for 20 years, and I remember going back about 20 years ago because I used to sell computer and networking equipment to the government, and I remember meeting with NASA and them unveiling their plans to really study the Earth. This new time lapse shows 20 years of life on Earth. Can you tell us what is happening as you look at all this data?
Yes, what we have in our visualization, which anyone can find at nasa.gov/earth. We have a visualization from a series of NOAA and NASA Earth viewing satellites that study photosynthesis on land and photosynthesis in the oceans. And we do it at the same time. And not only do we do this, but we do it week after week, month after month, year after year. I've now done this for 20 years. And so this is really cool. It's visually compelling, but scientifically, it's also an intercalibrated data set of photosynthesis in the oceans and on land, so it can be used quantitatively.
And looking at it, it's the Earth that's breathing every single day, changing with the seasons, responding to the sun, the changing winds, ocean currents, temperatures. It's a breathing organism.
Yes, it is, and you explain it very well, exactly as I would explain it. It's a breathing organism. You see it functioning. When you have data over 20 years, you can start to look for average conditions and departure from average conditions and where those departures occur, and then investigate and confirm why they occurred, where they occurred, and this becomes very interesting scientifically.
And Dr. Tucker, you mentioned in one of the animations that you know several astronauts, and they have orbited the Earth a number of times, and they all say the same thing. What is that that they say?
What they say is that even if they were military test pilots or military fighter pilots, that when they observe the Earth from space, this was a humanizing, almost spiritual experience for them, because they look out at the void of space, the darkness of space, all these stars. They look down at the Earth. It's a vibrant planet. Conditions are changing, the clouds, the oceans, the land, snow in some places at some times. And this is really compelling, and it makes us all realize we're part of this isolated life on one planet, the Earth. And it's very powerful. And friends of mine who have been astronauts tell me that they slept very little while they were on the International Space Station or while they were up in the space shuttle, because they were continually looking down at the Earth and how it was changing and how beautiful it is.
One climate, one planet.
Yes, one climate, one planet is a very good way to sum it up.
Well, what trends, overarching trends, has NASA observed over the last 20 years?
Well, one of the things I study is photosynthesis on land. And what we see from satellite data over the past 20 years is that spring is coming earlier, fall is coming later, especially at higher northern latitudes, because the planet is getting warmer. And so we're able to look and see more photosynthesis because we have warmer conditions and the growing season is getting longer.
And you have developed something called the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, and you've been with NASA for some time. Can you tell us what that is?
Okay. One of the tools we use to study photosynthesis on land is the Normalized Difference Vegetation Index, and that's a long name for something which is very simple. We take reflected light in the red region of the spectrum and in the near-infrared spectrum just beyond the upper limit of our vision. We subtract the red from the near-infrared, and then we divide that difference by the sum of those two measurements, the same two measurements. This then gives you a value which ranges from -1 to +1, and the positive values are directly associated with photosynthesis. So this is the tool we use. It's also used by farmers who have special devices, which are pretty cheap, on tractors, and they can actually make measurements of this same Normalized Difference Vegetation Index as they drive around their fields. They also have differential GPSs on their tractors, so they can actually make images of their fields and then use this information to know where they should fertilize, for example, or where not to fertilize.
And your folks have sent me some materials, and one of the examples in the materials is the grasslands of Senegal as they undergo their drastic seasonal changes. Can you describe what those changes are as we move through the seasons?
Sure. One of the first places I started working was in the grasslands of the Sahelian zone on the south side of the Sahara. There you have a pulsed monsoonal rainy season, which starts around the 1st of August, and then it's over by the end of October. So all of the plant growth which occurs in that short 3 or 4 month period. And it's a very flat area. It's extremely hot because you're only about 15 or 16 degrees north. You're on the south side of the Sahara, and that's a great place to study photosynthesis in grasslands because you have this short growing season. And when you look at it, it'll be completely dry. It looks like a very, very a desert-like environment. Then the rainy season comes, and you almost don't recognize it because in the space of a few days, it's turned very, very green, and it looks kind of like a golf course or a park or a country club. And this remarkable change happens, and then when the rainy season ends, it dries out again, and you wouldn't recognize it from how it was 1 month earlier.
Yeah. And the northern hemisphere that has so much vegetation, what surprised me in looking at some of the pictures and the simulations was the change in carbon on a seasonal basis. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes. What happens is when spring comes and plants start growing in the northern hemisphere, you have a huge pulse of photosynthesis. Plants, when they photosynthesize, absorb carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. They use water, which they bring up from their roots. They absorb sunlight to drive the reaction of photosynthesis. And you see a great pulse of photosynthetic activity. You see this especially in the corn and soybean belt of our country, where you see very productive farms. And it's because growing conditions there are so good, this is where we grow a lot of our crops.
Okay.
And it's dramatic. As soon as the growing season starts, these activities can be observed from space, from satellites, and they're dramatic and very impressive.
And how many satellites were involved over this 20-year period?
Well, there are probably a total of about 8 or 10 different satellites. So, for example, when we started off, we were using data from a satellite called CWIFS, which is a satellite which was initially or primarily designed to study phytoplankton in the oceans and their photosynthesis, but it was also extremely useful for vegetation on land. Then those data overlapped with a satellite which was launched in 2000 and another satellite which was launched in 2002, and those were two NASA satellites which were launched to study primarily the land, but also the ocean. And then these data have been continued by a NOAA and NASA satellite, which was launched in 2012, which then continues these measurements and is continuing them right now. So these data have resulted from these five NOAA and NASA satellites, and we merged the data quantitatively, so we're measuring the same thing with the same error and with the same uncertainty, so we can then use these data to see how every place, everywhere in the oceans and on land, are things changing? Are they constant? If they're changing, then we investigate to determine why they're changing.
Do you happen to know how big the data set is?
The data set is on the order of just about 1.5 petabytes, but it's a huge volume of data. And one of the reasons it's not larger is because these are coarse resolution data, where the smallest area which we're looking at is maybe 250 meters by 250 meters. And in the case of CWIFS data, the smallest area which we're looking at is 1 kilometer by 1 kilometer. And the reason that these data are so coarse in resolution is because we get them for the entire Earth's surface every day.
Right.
And this then enables us to combine the data and to get data where we can see the Earth's surface and the ocean surface and the land surface where there are no clouds. And that's why these data are so useful, is we can view the surface of the planet without clouds.
1.5 petabytes. Boy, I thought it'd be a lot more than that. That's fascinating. What tools do you use to analyze all of this to be able to take a look for what you're looking for and also to be able to maybe find things that you're not looking for?
Well, the first thing we have to do is we have to intercalibrate the data to make sure that we're looking at and actually measuring the same numerical value in the oceans and on land for photosynthesis. And to do this, with calibration with the CWIFS satellite, it flipped every month and imaged the moon, and we use the moon as the calibration for CWIFS. For the other satellites, they don't flip and image the moon. We have to use targets on the Earth's surface. So then we have to determine how the various spectral bands, in this case these two spectral bands, for land, but for the oceans, we use a total of 6 or 7 spectral bands.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to make sure that our measurements are consistent and we're measuring the same thing quantitatively. Then we merge the data. They have to be processed on very capable large computers or large capacity computers. We process the data daily, and then we merge them together to form a composite image every 8 days, every 16 days. And then we have the data, which are not only visually compelling and really interesting to look at, but they can be used for scientific studies.
Okay. What is the most surprising thing that you have learned through this process?
One of the things which really surprised me, I also, I'm very interested in climate and give talks on climate. And the best indicator of whether the planet is warming or cooling is sea level rise. And that's measured by radar altimeters on several satellites. And in 2010 and 2011, the rate of sea level rise to that point was about 3 millimeters, 3.5 millimeters per year, and suddenly sea level fell by 2 or 3 millimeters before it recovered in 2012 and came back to where it was before. So the question was, where did all that water go? Well, in looking at this visualization, which we have now of 20 years of satellite data of the oceans and land, if you look in the interior of Australia, there was this massive rainfall or impoundment of water there, and that's where the water went. And for me, that was really astounding that this much water could have fallen in the interior of Australia. And I was very surprised.
Wow, that is, yeah. And I'm curious, as far as rising sea levels, what percentage of that would be attributed to melting ice from land masses and what percentage from the expansion of water due to warming waters, thermal expansion?
About 60% of the rise is due to the melting of ice, primarily from the ice sheets of Greenland and Antarctica, and to a lesser extent from some of the concentrations of the mountain glaciers, like in the Gulf of Alaska or in Patagonia. And 40%, as you said, is due to thermal expansion.
Okay.
And we get that 40% from thermal expansion from almost 4,000 Argo floats, which are floats which are deployed in the oceans. They record salinity and temperature. They descend to 1,000 meters depth in the oceans. They drift for 9 or 10 days. Then they go down slightly deeper, and then they slowly surface, recording temperature and salinity. And it's from those data that we know what the temperatures are in the oceans and can determine what the thermal expansion of the oceans is.
Right, exactly. And do those devices also help us in the prediction of tsunamis, or are those different devices?
Those are different devices.
Okay. All right. So a last question. You know, you're a very curious person. What one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet?
Well, what my coworkers and I are trying to do is we're trying to measure photosynthesis on land for the past 36 or 37 years and do so really accurately. And at the moment, we're not sure of what our units are. So we're trying to combine data from satellites which measure chlorophyll fluorescence with satellites which use the normalized difference vegetation index and figure out the units from the chlorophyll fluorescence data, which then we can transfer to the normalized difference data, because the chlorophyll fluorescence data are only available starting in 2007 to now.
Okay.
And we want to extend this back in time, back to 1981, 1982. So this is one of the things which I would really like to do. We're working on it. So far, we don't have an answer.
I want to mention to our listeners that we have put up pictures, simulations, animations, and other videos on our website and also on our Facebook page as companion pieces to this interview. Dr. Compton Tucker, senior research scientist who's joined us from Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. Dr. Compton, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science
Radio. You're
very
welcome. It was my pleasure, and I send my best regards to all of your listeners.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And again, that was Dr. Compton Tucker, a senior research scientist for NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. Sorry, I had to sit that one out, John, but really interesting. You know, it makes me think of that series of films about Planet Earth. Did you ever see those?
Oh, yeah.
I've just had a revisit of those, David Attenborough. I've got these couple 20-something-year-olds living at my house, and they were watching those, and they were just amazed at our planet Earth. They were flabbergasted, laughing, and, you know, unbelievable at the images of our Earth. So wonderful that we can have these things that bring us some curiosity about the Earth.
So I was there 20 years ago. Of course, NASA's been doing these wonderful things in exploration of our solar system and our sun and learning different things. And, of course, got us to the moon and back a whole bunch of times. And it was about 21 years ago that they sat us down because I was with a technology firm that was doing a lot of business with the government. And we sat down with NASA and they said, we have this new program. We're putting up 8 satellites and we're going to be totally focused on Earth. And we've studied land masses. We've studied oceans before, but we've never studied land masses and oceans and the living aspects of Earth, the actual plant life at the surface of the ocean and at the surface of the Earth. And it was 20 years, and they collected a petabyte and a half of data, which is a tremendous amount mm-hmm. of data, if you want to understand how big that is. So a gigabyte, well, so a bit is a zero or a one. It's nothing. A byte is 8 bits, and that makes up maybe a word, maybe 2 words. A kilobyte's 1,000 bytes, a megabyte's 1,000,000 bytes, a gigabyte's 1,000,000,000 bytes, a terabyte's 1,000,000,000,000 bytes, a petabyte is 1 quadrillion bytes. So they had 1.5 petabytes, which is, if you take 4,000 high-definition photos a day for your entire life, that makes up roughly a petabyte.
Wow.
Or 745 million floppy disks, or, you know, it's a lot.
That's some robust amount of imagery. Well, let's take a quick underwriting break, and then we'll be back with our second guest, Dr. Scott Braun. We're looking forward to that conversation. It's Cool Science Radio. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is newly renovated and located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street. We are open nightly at 5:30 p.m. and serve eclectic American cuisine. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design. Love your home.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells. I'm here with Lynn Ware Peake. There were 17 named storms during the 2017 hurricane season, which ended 2 weeks ago. Harvey and Irma, well, they blasted the U.S. coast with winds exceeding 130 miles per hour. Maria hammered Puerto Rico with winds exceeding 155 miles per hour. Totals are still being calculated, but the early numbers indicate that the U.S. suffered more than $200 billion worth of damage, making it the most expensive hurricane season in U.S. history. Our first guest this morning, Dr. Scott Braun, who previously led NASA's Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission. He now heads the future 2020 Tropics Hurricane mission. Dr. Braun, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Morning.
Good morning. Before we talk about the 2017 season or talk about what we've learned from it, let's talk a bit about where you have come from. You led NASA's Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission, which was a 5-year mission using unmanned aircraft to investigate Atlantic hurricanes. Tell us about that.
Sure. It was the project that was funded under a program through NASA headquarters called Earth Venture. It was a suborbital set of missions, so basically using aircraft. And we were trying to use two of NASA's Global Hawk unmanned aircraft. These are fairly large drones, about a wingspan of 116 feet, 46 or so feet long, and they can fly for over 24 hours. And so we equipped them with a suite of sensors on one aircraft. The sensors were really geared toward measuring the environment of the storm, particularly the winds around the storm. And the other one was equipped with a number of sensors for looking at the inner core structure, the rainfall fields and things like that. And so we flew for 3 years, unfortunately not the best years for hurricane activity, which is good for most people but not as good for us. But we got some really exciting science out of it. Probably two of our most interesting cases was Hurricane Nadine in 2012, where we were looking at how Nadine was interacting with the very hot, dusty air that comes off the Saharan Desert with these storms. And then also Hurricane Edward in 2014, that was a storm that came pretty close to what we call rapid intensification, where it went from, it basically increased in wind speed by about 30 knots in 24 hours.
And Dr. Braun, with the sophistication increasing of the instrumentation packages that are put up in these satellites, will there be a point in time where we don't have to send aircraft into the eye of a hurricane? That seems like risky business.
Well, in this case, the aircraft was flying up above the storm, so it wasn't as risky, although it's fairly intensive work. I view the satellites and the aircraft as being highly complementary. The satellites give us a lot of valuable information. Some of the more advanced satellites allow you to see the precipitation in the storm, such as our Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. And then there's the GOES satellite that we build and then provide to NOAA that they use operationally that really give you a lot of information about the evolution of the storm. But you're really there only seeing the cloud tops, although with the latest generation, I think we're getting a bit more information. But the aircraft allows you to get far more detailed information. You can get high-resolution radars to scan the precipitation and winds, drop zones, which are small packages that are released from the planes that can give you profiles of temperature, humidity, and wind speeds, really help you to map out the flow and the environmental characteristics of these storms. So the aircraft can do stuff that the satellites can't do and vice versa. Again, they're very complementary.
And so, Dr. Braun, you had been this particular mission, the Sentinel mission, lasted about 5 years. But how long have you been using drones to fly into the eye of a storm or above a storm to gather information?
Well, we first used the Global Hawk in 2010 for another campaign. And then we did 3 years of flights with the Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission in 2012 to 14. And with those missions, we were really focused on basic research, you know, trying to understand how hurricanes form and intensify. We partnered with NOAA, particularly toward the end of the Sentinel mission. And then in the 2 years after that, NOAA used the Global Hawk in their own campaigns to try to look at how they can use the aircraft and the data that you get from the aircraft pull that information into the forecast models and see whether or not you can get an improvement of the forecast. And I think their initial modeling results are indeed showing that they do get some improvement, not only in terms of the forecasted tracks of the storms, but even for the forecasted intensity of the storms. And then the last mission was this past year. It was more of a training mission for young scientists and young engineers to get experience doing field work, but they worked with NOAA again to try to collect data sets that could be useful for evaluating the operational models and doing some basic science.
So NASA is doing a lot of amazing things with charting and tracking weather. You've got the drones and the satellites. You've got the Global Precipitation Measurement Program, which takes sort of a cross-section look at weather and especially extreme weather. And you've mentioned here a couple of times that you're delivering some of this data to NOAA, but I'm also wondering, you know, how does the National Weather Service use this, or how does, for example, here in Utah, you know, we talk often to the avalanche forecasters, and we wonder, you know, are they using NASA's research? How much exchange of information is there, and how can NASA enrich what these, you know, smaller entities are doing?
Yeah, well, NASA's got a fairly healthy applications effort. Talking about the Global Precipitation Mission, or GPM mission, one of our most widely used products is a merged satellite product, where GPM is we have a core satellite that NASA launched that provides very accurate rainfall measurements, but there's a whole constellation of satellites, both from the U.S. and internationally, that can measure precipitation. And GPM helps us to combine the estimates from all those different satellites into a merged product that's available every half hour at about a 10-kilometer spatial scale. That product is used for monitoring floods, whether it's from the hurricanes or other events. It informs models that try to predict the likelihood of floods and landslides and things of that sort. It's also used for agriculture purposes, drought monitoring, even disease tracking. You know, a lot of diseases occur in areas that have heavy flooding, and so by being able to track the rainfall, you can identify areas that might be prone to that. Mm-hmm. Now, in the U.S., it's not quite as important because we have a really good network of ground radars as part of the National Weather Service radar network. But there's most of the rest of the world, other than Europe, really lacks good quality radars, if they have radars at all. And rain gauges only cover a very small fraction of the land surface, and, of course, nothing over the oceans. So we need the satellite precipitation measurements to be able to estimate rainfall in these areas outside of the U.S. and Europe. And at least from a science perspective, we also want to know rainfall over the oceans, because that's what's driving a lot of the Earth's circulation. So it's pretty important to have these satellite measurements.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Scott Braun. He's from Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. He's been running a number of very special hurricane missions. Dr. Braun, I wanted to ask you, my understanding, you know, warm seawater evaporates, and then at a certain altitude where it's cooler, it condenses. When it condenses, it gives off a kinetic energy, and when that's released, that has something to do with the formation or the strengthening or the weakening of a hurricane. Can you kind of, you know, before we talk about the 2017 season and what we've learned, can you kind of take us back and give us a little primer on how hurricanes form?
Yeah, there's certain key ingredients that are needed to get hurricanes. Probably first and foremost is you need warm ocean temperatures, typically greater than about 26 degrees Celsius. The warmer the ocean water, the stronger the storms can potentially get. It doesn't mean they'll get up to that maximum intensity, because there may be other influences that prevent them from getting there, but certainly the warmer the ocean, the stronger the storms can become. You also need high humidity, because that favors cloud development. Dry air, if it gets into the storms, tends to disrupt the thunderstorms and precipitation systems that help to spin up a storm. You also need what's called relatively weak vertical wind shear. So wind shear is how the winds are changing with height. And typically, favorable conditions is when the winds have very little change with height. But if you get a situation where the jet stream, for example, is pushing far enough south that you get stronger winds at upper levels, it basically can rip apart a storm, both at early stages and at later stages. If you get a mature hurricane, it can weaken it. And then you usually need some sort of initial disturbance that really kicks off the process. In the Atlantic, that initial disturbance is often associated with atmospheric waves that come off of the off of Africa. These are called African easterly waves, and they move westward in the tropical Atlantic, and they're usually associated with big complexes of thunderstorms. And those thunderstorms are what really acts to concentrate the rotation that's in these waves down to smaller and smaller scales, and gradually increasing the intensity of those winds. And then from that point, it just depends on how favorable the environmental conditions are and the sort of ocean temperatures that the storm encounters that determines how intense it may get.
And the vertical wind shear you're talking about, I'm thinking back to Superstorm Sandy when it took an unexpected hard left turn into northern New Jersey and New York. Did that have something to do with a weakening of the vertical wind shear?
Well, Sandy was a particularly unique situation because by the time it was moving northward off the coast, it was interacting with a mid-latitude weather system. And so by the time it made that sharp turn into the New York area, it was really starting to take on characteristics of more of an extratropical system. So there was actually fairly large wind shear possible, but instead of just getting energy off of the ocean, by that point it was starting to feed off of energy in the what we call the temperature gradients, or the changes in temperature across some scale, basically associated with the frontal system, for example. And so the storm was basically changing the source of energy that it was drawing from, and that's what allowed it, even though it was a weak hurricane by the time it was moving up the coast, that interaction, I think, kept it fairly intense and also broadened the wind field substantially so that it had a very large impact.
Wow, changing the source of energy that it's drawing from. Now, what's the predictability of that when you're looking at your data and the work that you're doing? Were you able to see that, you know, ahead of time at all? And if so, how much?
Well, NASA doesn't necessarily do prediction per se. That's usually NOAA that does that. But we were certainly seeing in a lot of the forecast models, both the NOAA models as well as some of the European models, the likely track of Sandy. In fact, the European models picked up on that turn in toward New York much earlier than the U.S. models. And we're talking, you know, 5 to 7 days out. The models were at least seeing the storm moving up the coast, and the European model picking up earlier that it would go into New York, and then the NOAA model did eventually as well. So the predictive capabilities have improved quite a bit. I'd say over the last 30 years, we've seen improvements in track forecasts, so that now the 2-day track forecast or the 5-day forecast for track are as good as the 2-day tracks forecast used to be, say, 20, 30 years ago. So that's a huge amount of improvement. In terms of storm intensity, it's still a much more difficult problem because storm intensity depends on a range of scales, including very small scales, whereas track is governed more by the larger scales. And those smaller scales tend to be much harder to predict. They're more chaotic, in essence. And I think we are starting to see some progress in some of the NOAA forecast models in intensity forecasts, and that's driven partly because the models are getting better, the observations are getting better, and our ability to get those observations into the model to better describe within the model what the storm looks like. That's really critical to getting a good forecast. And all those things have been improving. And I think with continued research and investment in those areas, we can continue to see forecast improvements in the years to come.
Yeah. So Hurricane Harvey, the costliest tropical cyclone on record, mostly because it hit the Houston metropolitan area, the last couple weeks and into early September of this year. Let's talk a little bit about that, because a lot of news has come out this week about some research that has been done, a couple of independent studies that are all in agreement about how hurricanes are changing due to climate change.
Yeah, this it gets to be fairly complicated, so it might lead to a bit of a long answer. But in terms of the impact of climate change on hurricanes, given that the warm ocean is the source of energy for hurricanes, we generally expect that as climate change warms the oceans, you're going to see a greater likelihood of more intense storms and perhaps more storms, although the models tend to show that the numbers aren't changing a whole lot, but maybe the frequency of these extreme events might increase. The predictions also suggest that as the air temperatures also warm, that the air can hold more water vapor, so you can squeeze out more precipitation. Mm-hmm. For about a degree change in the atmospheric temperature, you might get an extra 6 to 10% of rainfall. So certainly, in the long term, we do expect the potential for more intense storms. Now, these particular studies were looking at the extreme rainfall in Harvey relative to past occurrences of rainfall extremes. And what they were finding was that the total rainfall was certainly on the very extreme end when you compare it to past extremes, and that these extreme rainfall events, which include more than just hurricanes, it can be any sort of event, but that they've been gradually increasing with time as the atmosphere warms. And so they made the conclusion that, well, Harvey must have been due to, in large part, to climate change. The one problem that I found in browsing through these studies is that it ignores one of the key aspects of Harvey that made it so unique. So the total rainfall that an area gets is a function of how heavy is it raining and how long is it raining. So by not decomposing their analysis into rainfall intensity versus duration, mm-hmm. it kind of confuses things a bit. Now, Harvey was unique because it moved inland very slowly, kind of hung out for a bit, and then moved back out over the Gulf. So it basically sat over that area for about 6 days. So even if the rainfall rates had intensities that were comparable, say, to 1900, if it sat over the area for 6 days, you're going to get record rainfall. The warmer air, if it led to a 6% or let's say 10% increase in rainfall, and if a storm following a normal track might produce 20 to 30 inches of rainfall, then maybe you squeeze an extra 2 or 3 inches out. But we're talking 5 feet of rain in this case. The rainfall intensity certainly weren't so extreme that it led to that much, and it was really just that slow motion that contributed to the extremes here. So I'm a little hesitant at accepting their conclusions. I think they do show that extreme rainfall is increasing, but whether Harvey's event was due to climate change or not, I think they really have to look at, well, to what extent could climate change affect the track of storms? And I think that is something that really hasn't been looked at.
We have some data going back to the 1800s. We certainly have collected a lot of data in the last 30 years. What sorts of trends are you seeing? What can we expect in the future?
This is always one of the difficult questions when it comes to trends because, yeah, we have records going back to the 1800s, but you got to think about how we were observing storms over that entire period. Early on, it was based mostly on either land reports or ship reports. Of course, assuming that a ship survived a major hurricane, that is, to get the data out. So there's a lot more uncertainty in those early years about the intensities, unless it was a landfalling storm. And there probably were a lot of storms that were missed because we didn't have satellites to see them from space. So you have to be very cautious with trends using that early period. Now, in the satellite era, we have generally seen an upward trend. And if you look at the Atlantic in particular, if you go from the early 70s to what we have now, there's definitely been an increase. But that's too short of a period to be looking at a trend in terms of climate change because in addition to climate change effects, there's also what's called a multi-decadal cycle in Atlantic hurricane activities where you'll have a 20 to 30-year period where hurricanes are very active, and then a 20 to 30-year period where they're fairly inactive. And our satellite record started pretty much at the beginning of that inactive period, and then now we're sort of in the middle, maybe getting toward the end of an active period. So I really think that we need the satellite observations probably for another 10, 20, 30 years before we can conclusively say, based on the satellite data, that there's been a trend in hurricane activity. I mean, certainly the model suggests that trend should be there, but our ability to detect that trend when the data types and quality have changed over the years makes things very difficult in terms of detection.
Yeah, and trends was really probably the wrong word because you can probably really look at trends over many thousands of years. You know, the record is there for us. Or most of the records there. But I was curious about, I think you're a curious person and you've been studying this all your life. What one question would you like to have answered that has not been answered yet about hurricanes?
I really have two. Among my top questions, I have two that are particularly important. One is, you know, we see storms like Maria that undergo very rapid intensification. Maria doubled its wind speed from 80 to 160 mile an hour in just 24 hours. We call that rapid intensification, and that's something that we still don't understand very well. How much of that is driven by what's going on in the environment of the storm? How much of it is what's going on internally within the storm? What kicks it off? And, you know, just a number of things like that that we're interested in. That's been a major focus of some of the NASA field campaigns that we've done in recent years. One of the other big questions that I've been involved in now since probably the last 8 years or so is how the storms are affected by this Saharan air layer that I mentioned earlier, this hot, dry, dusty air mass that comes off, usually moving to the north of storms. And there's been a fair bit of debate about whether that air mass tends to favor the development of storms or if it tends to suppress them or maybe in the net not have much of an impact. There's still a lot of active research in that area. We have a lot of satellite observations that allow us to track that Saharan air. But really diagnosing how much it's impacting a storm requires a lot of sophisticated modeling that we're starting to do, but the models have to be sophisticated enough to account for the effects of the dust in the cloud formation and precipitation formation and then how that feeds back to the dynamics of the storm. And that's fairly complicated at this point. So I think in the years ahead, as the models improve and as we get additional observations, we'll be able to make more progress probably on both of those questions.
As you were talking before about Hurricane Nadine, back in 2012, you had done this research on the Saharan, the dust blowing off the Sahara and the extreme high daytime temperatures. It made me wonder that very thing, if the predictability about a hurricane that is receiving energy from the, or as you say, how the dust interacts with the hurricane versus how warming water is interacting with the hurricane. Do you feel like, I mean, obviously that's part of the bigger question, but do you feel like there's more predictability about what warming water does than what warming land mass does?
Well, the warming, you know, the storms are getting most of their energy from the water. Once they get over land, they're cut off from their moisture source, so they typically weaken. And so that doesn't make as much of a difference as just the ocean temperatures. Now, if you have an area, let's say Florida has had heavy rainfall before a hurricane comes on and the ground is pretty much saturated or you got standing water, then you may find that the storm really doesn't feel the effects of the land all that much. Some people call this brown ocean effect, just because normally the normal dry land that a storm might feel as it goes inland, if it's saturated or covered with standing water, it basically treats it almost as if it's like beating over the ocean still. But if you don't have that moisture source, the storm's typically going to decrease because the land has creates more friction at the bottom of the storm, and that tends to drive down the wind speeds over time. So storms typically decay fairly quickly once they make landfall.
Mm. So what do you say to folks when you meet them at a cocktail party or something, especially around fall of this year at the end of the hurricane season? The 2017 season was, you know, depending on what you read, 12, 16 different hurricanes in the Atlantic. You know, when they ask you, what's up with that? What do you say?
Well, it's always a difficult question. You know, certainly the topic of climate change comes up, and that could be playing a role, but you have to look at what's going on the large scales. There wasn't much of an El Nino this year. El Ninos tend to suppress Atlantic hurricane activity. This year it was either neutral or it's possible that it's even gradually shifting toward a La Nina, which would tend to be more favorable, although that probably didn't factor in as much this year. I think the key thing was that the winds in the tropical environment of these storms tended to be much weaker, so that these storms were encountering much less shear, so that they weren't being ripped apart by the winds. In addition, the ocean temperatures over much of the Atlantic were on the order of 1 to 2 degrees above normal. So that means that there's a lot more energy available in general.
Right.
Whether that broad area of warmer waters is related to climate change. It certainly could be. It's certainly what we would expect, although there certainly can be other factors that affect ocean temperatures. But when we start to see consistently over the years that we're getting areas that are above normal ocean temperatures covering more and more of the ocean basin each year, that certainly suggests that conditions are gradually becoming more and more favorable for the formation and intensification of these storms. But then it also depends on how the atmosphere responds to those ocean temperatures as well, and whether that is acting in the same direction as the ocean effects, or if it maybe counters those ocean effects. That's part of the complication of trying to predict the future climate of hurricanes, is that the atmosphere may not respond in the same direction that the ocean warming ocean's trying to take things.
Right. So the fire season has extended. We're seeing longer fire season this year. Could the same be said for the hurricane season?
Yeah, there is some evidence that hurricane season gradually is getting longer. The season starts a bit earlier and goes a little bit later because the ocean temperatures are warm enough. So remember that the storms tend to form when the ocean temperatures get to a minimum of 26 degrees Celsius. So if you normally saw those ocean temperatures in June and now you're seeing them in May or April, the season can potentially start earlier. And if they last longer into November or December, then it can go later. So that certainly is a potential impact of warming ocean.
Dr. Brown, we just have a minute left, but I just have a quick question before we button up. And that's, we talked about how you led NASA's Hurricane and Severe Storm Sentinel mission. You're now the head project scientist for the future 2020 Tropics Hurricane mission. Could you quickly for us define what Tropics is? It's a big acronym. And also tell us what you're going to be doing.
Sure. I should say that Tropics is a mission that's being led actually by MIT Lincoln Labs, and I'm sort of the lead scientist at NASA for the mission. And basically the mission is a constellation of about 6 CubeSats. These are the very small satellites, not much bigger than a bread box.
Right.
And it's going to have an instrument on it that basically scans to and measures profiles of temperature and humidity, and can also give us information on the structure of rainfall within storms. And they'll fly in different orbits so that we get very frequent revisits of these overpasses. Now, typically from a lot of the polar orbiters that we have, you get observations from each one about twice a day. And since there are several of those, you might get, say, 6 observations a day. So the revisit rate may be on the order of 4 hours, maybe 3 hours. But we're trying, with this constellation of 6, to get revisit rates that start approaching 50 minutes, so a little bit less than an hour, so that we can get frequent views of the storm. Maybe we can get that data into the models, and by hitting the model frequently with this data and correcting the model, you can potentially improve the forecast of these storms. So it's a unique approach to getting observations from space, and I think it'll yield pretty valuable science, and we're hoping that ultimately as NOAA tries using it and NASA as well within their forecast models, that we can see some improvement in those forecasts.
Dr. Scott Braun from Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Sure, glad to help.
Okay.
And thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. Thank our underwriters, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway, Home Services, Utah Properties, Nexus IT, Habitat for Humanity Restore, the Natural History Museum of Utah, and Park City Mountain.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
You've been listening to KPCW Park City. Time now for national news.